Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
What exactly is psychopathy? What makes a person a psychopath? Can they control it? How does it come on? Does it ever go away? Those are just some of the many questions that I ask Dr. John Edens in this five-part series, What Makes a Psychopath? Here's another piece of that conversation. We hear the term psychopath thrown out there in almost every horrible murder case that we cover. And rightfully so. Some of these people really seem scary. And on the surface, if you're just to use the term psycho, as if you were to think of Norman Bates or something, some of these folks fit that description. But it goes much deeper than that. There is clinical psychopathy, but there's also what one would call psychopath in a courtroom, and they're very different things. John, you've been studying this for a very long time. I know it's a very open-ended question, but what does psychopath really mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and there are a lot of misperceptions about it, some fed by the media, both, you know, fictional and news media. And it is a term that gets used a lot to simply describe what we kind of, you know, in layperson language, think of as a bad person. That's how it comes up a lot in, you know, criminal cases. The original sort of basis of it in the history of mental health really was focused on a particular type of personality pattern that seemed to be pretty evident among subsets of patients in, you know, forensic hospitals and other facilities, and also in, you know, correctional settings that, you know, seemed very, very different from, you know, the typical sort of person with mental health problems that you might see in a psychiatric facility. And for your readers, if they want to see or read something that's really the probably the most widely cited and most sort of extensive discussion of what psychopaths are like in terms of how they present and interact with other people, there's a great book, actually first written in the 1940s by a guy named Hervey Cleckley, called The Mask of Sanity. And he was laid out a set of criteria that have been extremely influential in terms of personality traits that have formed the basis for what most people in the mental health field think of as psychopathic traits. And he believed that even though people that are highly psychopathic look normal, they're actually fundamentally very disconnected, particularly emotionally and in terms of attachments to other individuals. And that's one of the interesting things about it is he talked about it as being something where people look relatively normal or even better than normal. That's where the title Mask of Sanity comes from. Mm-hmm. And he basically argued that these are people that do not really have the capacity to form emotional connections with other people, but they look like they do, and they can use emotional language because they've been raised to think about and understand at a sort of a cognitive level what emotions mean and how emotions are used by other people. But they really fundamentally were disconnected from other individuals, to a more or less extreme sort of way. And that ties into, in many ways, the reason that we talk about psychopaths in the criminal justice field and the forensic world, because if you really don't have emotional connections to other people, And you're, you know, see individuals as essentially sort of objects to be used, then you can imagine that that really opens the door for people to potentially do horrendous types of things. You know, I talk about this in my undergrad classes quite a bit, you know, this idea that, and not to oversimplify things, but, you know, we, a lot of our actions in lives are particularly bad things that we might do are kept at bay because we feel guilt and anxiety. And I'm not saying that's the only thing that controls our behavior, but it's a big one, you know, the fear of getting in trouble, the fear of other people being upset and, you know, mad at us and hurt by what we've done. Yeah, those are important things to most people. But for highly psychopathic people at the kind of extreme end, those things aren't really there. And that's when, you know, when people ask me, what's the fundamental thing that makes highly psychopathic people different from, you know, the garden variety person walking around, that's the biggest one that comes to mind for me.
So essentially, someone who is psychopath, on a, I mean, we're talking in fairly general terms here, would be missing the anxiety standpoint and the guilt standpoint that most of us would feel based on our actions. It's like a bumper, if you will, where most of us have that, and that bumper is enough to lead us down a path where we're not hitting it as frequently. But if that bumper isn't there, it's easier for a psychopath to exceed it and just go outside the lines. However, as you noted, and it should be noted, learned behavior. Even if you don't necessarily have those bumpers there in your mind and they're there to bounce you back, you can learn that, okay, others seem to have these boundaries over here. Maybe I should operate like they're there, even if they're not. Is that how a lot of psychopaths can get by without being, you know, essentially noticed or picked up on, or just so they can function in life if they're not the let's go kill people type psychopath?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and in fact, there have been some attempts to develop treatment programs that really focus more on not trying to train somebody to have empathy or teach them, you know, how to genuinely connect emotionally with other people, but to take a more somewhat self-serving approach where how can you avoid screwing up your life by continually getting arrested or running into trouble? And those programs tend to focus on the sort of things that you're talking about, you know, sort of even if it's just from a self-serving point of view, interacting with people in a way to minimize the likelihood that you're going to screw up your own life. That can be a hard thing to sell to people, because another thing that's fairly common among psychopathic individuals at the more extreme end is a usually oftentimes wildly irrational self-confidence in their ability to do things like manipulate people, get away with stuff that, you know, they're actually likely to get caught at. That was one of the things that Herbie Cleckley talked about, you know, in his seminal book, where, you know, a lot of these people would make amazingly bad choices that, you know, screwed up their own lives in a real objective sort of way, but who went into it thinking like, well, this is going to be a breeze, or I'm not going to have any trouble, or I'm going to easily be able to get, you know, my goals, get to whatever I want. And, you know, so that's a challenge oftentimes, you know, when you're talking about people that don't necessarily do a great job of, you know, learning from their mistakes, which is another thing that you tend to see, is that, you know, people that are highly psychopathic seem to be prone to not really learning from their past, you know, misdeeds or situations where they've gotten in trouble before.
Why is that? Why is it that, I mean, it seems fairly obvious to most of us who are not psychopathic that, you know, you can learn from your past deeds. You may go into something that can also be great, and then it turns out to be an utter nightmare and a very bad choice. But you make that, you learn because it didn't work out well. What's missing there? Why is it that doesn't seem to click for someone who is a psychopath? Well, that turned out horribly. Why do it again if it didn't work out the first time?
I mean, if we had the answer to that question, we could probably make a lot of money developing, you know, treatment programs. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of interesting scientific research going on, and I'm not a neuroscientist, but a lot of people are looking at brain systems that are responsible for sort of managing you know, those types of, you know, basic kind of foundational learning things that sort of go on in the brain. And there are people out there that are arguing that the brains of psychopaths are in many ways, functionally at least, pretty different from the average sort of person out there. You know, some of that research, I'd love to see a bit more replication of those sorts of findings. But, you know, there's people arguing at least that it's it may fundamentally be, you know, sort of a, and again, this is an oversimplification, but kind of a brain chemistry sort of issue, which has real interesting legal implications if you're talking about, you know, sort of holding somebody responsible for their actions and punishing them for those actions, which is what, you know, our criminal justice system is designed to do. But what if you've got somebody who, you know, didn't ask to be born this way and lacks some things that would normally inhibit bad behavior that the rest of us seem to have developed over the course of our lives, and where punishment isn't necessarily probably going to have all that much of an impact on them. It's a real fascinating sort of legal discussion. And, you know, some law professors and people like that have kind of written about, you know, this question and talked about it in regards to, you know, is it fundamentally fair to hold psychopaths, you know, sort of responsible for things if they don't actually have the capacity to prevent themselves from engaging in those types of things. You know, that's kind of a highfalutin academic debate at some level, because I've never seen a jury that would kind of buy that sort of argument. But it is an interesting issue. And, you know, in our legal system, when you've got somebody that you can convince the courts that they really can't control their behavior, they really can't control their behavior, potentially their violent behavior, and that they have some sort of mental disorder and that they're a danger potentially to other people, you know, you can civilly commit individuals like that, where before having even committed a crime, you know, you can take away their rights and put them in a psychiatric facility. And we tend to do that for people with disorders more like schizophrenia or other disorders where people are having, you know, psychotic symptoms. But, you know, there are several states in the U.S. right now and a lot of other places around the world that are actually using and incorporating a psychopathy diagnosis to do that with people who are highly psychopathic, not people that we tend to think of as, you know, mentally ill in the sense of having, you know, schizophrenia and being delusional and irrational. That's happening a lot right now in the U.S. in sexually violent predator cases, where people that are about to be released from prison, they have a history of sex crimes, and someone and the state decides they're still a danger to society. They can be labeled, if they, again, if you can convince the jury that somebody is a danger to society and they have a mental disorder. And psychopathy is used frequently to make that sort of argument. You can have people who get locked up in psychiatric facilities that actually oftentimes look a lot like prisons that they just got out of after they completed their sentences. So, you know, it's a diagnosis that can have real, really life-altering consequences for the people who get labeled as such in the criminal justice system.
You're locked into the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want more? Start binging on all of our true crime podcasts right now through Apple Podcasts and get an ad-free experience when you sign up to be a True Crime Today Premium Plus member exclusively on Apple Podcasts.
More of the Hidden Killers podcast dropping soon.
Press subscribe now.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.